One of the toughest problems facing the early church was what to include in the New Testament, the makeup of the final canon of Scripture. There was plenty of material around purporting to tell the Christian story, but not everything could be included and not everything should be included. One criterion that was used, one measure, was that of authorship. If a book had been written by one of the apostles, it went in. If it wasn't written by an apostle, well, it had to be very good indeed to find its way into the sacred canon of Scripture, that select group of writings that would, in the coming centuries, serve as the record of the faith, the key text on which the faith of the church would be built. As we read the account of the Emmaus Road encounter in Luke's Gospel, Luke, who was, of course, not an apostle, so his material had to have about it the ring of authenticity. As we read his account of this curious incident on the road, we can see the sort of narrative that it made sense to include in that strict canon of Scripture. And we can see why it worked, why it merited inclusion. Because according to any reasonable criteria of critical judgment, it has the ring of truth about it. You can't help but notice the simple, undramatic nature of the narrative. No flashing lights from heaven, just two friends making their sad way home from a funeral, when they're joined by a third party with whom they talk and whom they invite for supper. As ordinary and as calm and as everyday as you could imagine, told with impressive simplicity and economy. With no desire to startle, no urge to raise the dramatic level, it's a story that seems pretty much to tell it as it was. Add to that the fact that the whole emotional picture is consistent. The feelings and reactions are perfectly normal, natural, commonplace. No one acts in a manner other than we would expect given the circumstances. The two followers of Christ talk mournfully about someone who has died. That happens every day. We've all been there. Their hopes have been dashed. Their shoulders are hunched. They have invested so much emotional capital in Jesus of Nazareth, and their disappointment and hurt is in direct proportion to that commitment. And we know how that dynamic works. The more of ourselves we invest in something or someone, the more hope or ambition we have nurtured, some dream we cherish, the more shocked and wounded we are when it all blows up in our face. They really had hoped that he was going to be the one to redeem Israel. Then the horror of Calvary mocked their dream and exposed their vulnerability. High hopes dashed forever. We do hear coming through the narrative the first faint glimmer of the slightest possibility of hope as the stranger interprets the terrible events in a new light, and they begin to see that there may be some other way of looking at the death of their friend. They half see that maybe, just maybe, the death of Jesus could in fact perhaps be entirely consistent with the will and purpose of God somehow. And the first murmured whisperings of Easter had come, that as part of that plan and purpose of God, he, Christ, would be raised from the dead and declared a Son of God in triumph and victory by the power of God the Father. But it's clear from their grudging, tentative response that we're not here dealing with people who believed that Jesus would be raised or even seriously considered the possibility that such a mighty act of power could happen. They were normal people who believed, naturally enough, that he was dead and gone for good. People they knew did not rise from the dead. He was gone. And they were not looking for his return. They were not crossing their fingers and hoping for his resurrection. That possibility, that impossibility, was not within the scope of their thinking. So, whatever happened on that evening walk, it certainly had nothing to do with people who had whipped themselves up into a frenzy of expectation and hoping, so that they somehow generated a kind of small group hallucination as some sort of wish fulfillment from the depth of their longing. The whole feeling of the passage is that, as people do, they simply wanted to be left alone with their broken dreams and their dead Messiah, to be given time to piece together the shattered fragments of their lives. all a very real, a very normal response. Indeed, no one is more surprised than they are by what follows. For even the manner in which Jesus reveals himself to them is shorn of drama. It's low-key, almost accidental. It is as he carries out the action that is so typical of himself that the disclosure moment comes, the penny drops, things click into place. His most characteristic act as their leader and teacher to give thanks and to break the bread. In that moment, the scales fall away from their eyes and they see, they know, they understand who he is, that he is the same Lord, the same Jesus. But no heavenly choirs, no reverberating strings, just something simple, commonplace and real. You might remember that famous spy story in which an undercover American agent working in Moscow gives himself away as he eats his meal in the Moscow restaurant, eating in the traditional American way, where they don't use their knife. His Russian accent was flawless, his clothing authentic, his papers all that they should have been, his cover story watertight, but one simple characteristic action revealed all. So it is with the risen Lord. No messages written in the sky, no choir soprano, just over tea, he lets them understand that he is Lord of life and death. The response of the two disciples to the wonder of what they've encountered shows again the convincing integrity of the story. They can't simply go to bed now as if something stupendous has not occurred. They must tell the others, let them know the miracle. And they rose that very night and returned to Jerusalem to tell the others the fabulous news, how he was known to them in the breaking of bread. Think what you would have done if it had been you in that situation. You would have done exactly what they did. You would have run the 7 miles back to the city, regardless of the gathering gloom and the fact that you'd just come from there, to tell the others the stupendous news that it was true. And once again, we bump up against the authentic feel of the story. If it was going to happen, this is just how it would have happened. It sounds right. It feels right. Luke's down-to-earth ordinariness is very convincing. He's not trying to impress us. Rather, he just wants to tell us what happened, pure and simple. And what conclusions are we to draw? It seems that really only two offer themselves with any force. One, that the early church miscalculated badly and included what is clearly and palpably an obvious fiction full of exaggerations and distortions within the sacred historic canon of Scripture. Or else, like us, they were impressed by this account, convinced that it occurred as described. For my money, the integrity of this passage speaks with force and persuasiveness. The unassuming honesty of it hits you like an express train. And what Cleopas and the other mysterious unnamed disciple discovered, the church has found to be true for 2,000 years. That on the road, on our road, the living Christ can meet us, take our sorrows and our sense of loss, take our confusion and our hesitancy, and inject the hope and the life of his risen power, his victory, into them, into us. He can enter our disappointments and place his encouragement there instead. Take the doubt that gnaws at our faith and replace it with the assurance that nothing in life or in death is stronger than his love and his life. And isn't it true, now as it has been in the life of the church for 2,000 years, that again and again he makes himself known to us and his victory available to us, as we share in the characteristic experience of discipleship, as we gather around his table and he breaks bread and meets us there, and we know with a clarity and a certainty that he is with us and his power is transforming and healing still here, now,